Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a new organization fighting to win a 28th Amendment to the United States Constitution to lessen money's political influence on elections and policy. American Promise launched a new chapter in Oklahoma over the weekend, a part of a nationwide effort to overturn the effects of the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, which held that political spending is a form of protected speech under the First Amendment and that government may not keep corporations, unions, or other legally recognized organizations like Super PAC from spending money to support or denounce individual candidates in elections. Already, 19 states have passed resolutions to ask Congress to convene a constitutional convention of states on this issue. The group is still considering the language of this amendment. They're spending 18 months hammering out consensus language, but current legislation in Congress would allow Congress and states to, one, regulate and limit the raising and spending of money in elections, and two, distinguish between people and artificial entities like corporations and set limits for the latter. And one bill would also change the interpretation of political spending as protected speech under the First Amendment. My guest today is Tamara Piety, an advisor to American Promise and a University of Tulsa law professor who specializes in First Amendment law. She joins us to talk about American Promise and the idea of adding a 28th Amendment to the Constitution. Tamara Piety, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, this weekend, American Promise launched its Oklahoma chapter to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision through a constitutional amendment. The idea is to, through the state, is pass a resolution which would encourage Congress to pass a possible new amendment, the 28th Amendment, which would overturn Citizens United. Why is this the best step for our democracy at this particular point?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues. And one of the things that is so heartening at this particular moment in time, this political moment, is that the unhappiness with Citizens United and the sort of corporate participation in politics is a bipartisan, cross-partisan. Surveys done on this question regularly return 80%, 90% of people unhappy with Citizens United and sort of the idea that we, the people, can't control the spending in politics. And I think we're seeing lots and lots of examples of where I think many of our elected representatives would rather be more responsive to the constituents that they have on whether it's healthcare or any number of other issues, but they're facing backlash from big donors. And sometimes that's individuals and sometimes it's corporations. This process is really just to get that conversation started, get the political momentum started at the grassroots level to try to address this problem.
So it's about putting limits on the cash needed for political office holders to seek each election cycle.
It's several things. Yeah. I mean, it's like right-sizing corporate rights, not saying, you know, corporations have no rights, but right-sizing them as compared to human beings. And also big money in politics, whether it's coming from corporations or from other places, which may be caps and limits.
So. Well, that's what I was going to say. It's not just corporations. It could be everything from partisan interest groups all along the entire political spectrum. That could be from the far left to far right.
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things, as I say, that makes this particular issue a great one for us here in Oklahoma and for many people across the country, is that it doesn't matter so much what your economic theories are or your social political commitments. There is widespread agreement that we've gotten that balance out of whack and that we need to get something back.
Well, it seems like every federal election cycle, the amount of money spent just goes up, not quite exponentially, but I mean, by a large percentage each and every cycle. This last presidential election spent far more money than the 2012 or 2008. I imagine in 2018, a lot more money will have been spent than 2014 or 2010. Will an amendment like this change the amount of money being raised or just the way and how the money is raised?
Well, let me just emphasize here, too, that an amendment is not a silver bullet, right? So a constitutional amendment that covered things like the relative voice of human beings and the need for protecting human beings versus entities, and trying to get some limits doesn't solve every problem. And it, you know, we may not even be able to do that in one amendment, but it provides a necessary sort of starting place for some of that. And I think, you know, there are probably going to be other things that will have to come down the pike from that in order to completely fix all of the problems that we're seeing here.
So I'm not necessarily know if I got an answer. Do you think it will actually lessen the amount of money that goes into elections?
Well, it should. The problem is we don't have here yet a specific text. We have a lot of groups like American Promise, and American Promise is starting to work with a lot of some of these other groups like Reclaim Democracy, Move to Amend, to write the 28th Amendment. So whether it will solve that depends on what the ultimate language is. Yeah. But I think that it's no matter what the ultimate language is, even if you don't solve it all, you provide the very important first step of where the political will is and what people want to see happening and trying to put the people in the democracy on top again, you know. So,
yeah, you know, I know just off of Capitol Hill,
right,
there are these whole groups of these little hotels or meeting rooms. And when you walk into one of these meeting rooms, they're just filled with phone jacks and phone lines. And it's for members of Congress to make calls for contributions. And from right. what I hear, it's pretty much a daily and weekly occurrence. They can't do it from their office because that's illegal.
Right.
So
right.
they go to these little locations just off Capitol Hill. And it's a significant part of their work week.
It's the bulk of most of elected officials. And, you know, former Senator Coburn has talked about this, and one of his concerns is term limits as a partial corrective to the, you know, some of the incentives that happen when people are long-term occupants of an office. But they spend too much time running, you know, trying to get money for running for office and getting funding, and not enough time talking to their constituents. And I'm sure there's some representatives out there somewhere who are fine with that, but I think the vast majority of them really do want to talk to their constituents more than to funders. Not that funders aren't also great folks, but the voters are the ones that ultimately are the, you know, where the rubber meets the road. And congressmen and women and senators are disabled from actually spending as much time as they would like to, I think.
So you earlier mentioned, says, you know, we don't even have the language. There are a couple of introduced resolutions in Congress. One is a sort of a middle-of-the-road amendment, and there's one that goes a little further. From American Promises and maybe the state chapter, what is the goal? Is it to come up with a common language first? Is it to pass a resolution to get Congress to consider something? Or where are we right now on this?
I think where we are right now and where the Oklahoma chapter is trying to raise consciousness in the legislature, in the public, of this issue, and to inspire people to contact their representatives and say, this is an important issue for me. When something like this comes up and passes your desk, I want you to vote for it. We care about this. Now, they have another group that I'm involved with that is really devoted to trying to come up with the specific language. But because this is a big group effort and there are a lot of folks, a lot of states involved, ultimately, you know, what we're due at American Promise may not be the final language. And compromise is part of the political process, right? We may not get everything that we want. But we want, what our goal right now here is to get the legislature, the Oklahoma legislature, involved with this, interested in this, because cities, the city of Tulsa, for instance, could pass a resolution. Many of the cities are taking the bull by the horns and they're saying, well, you know, our legislature's not ready to do this, but we're going to pass a statement of intent.
I think there are about 800 cities across the country. And when you actually look at a map, you look at some places that are very red states and some very blue
Absolutely.
States. You know, and really, and that's this gets to the heart of it. It's not necessarily a red-blue issue.
It is absolutely not. I mean, we've got Wyoming just passed something, I think, or they started a chapter, and former Senator Alan Simpson is on our Council of Advisors and is being really helpful there.
And they're raising signatures to put something on the ballot.
Yes, they are. And they want to put something on the ballot. It's just so popular that it hasn't been around very long, and it's already getting a lot of steam. And then on the other side of that aisle, we've got Massachusetts. And so, yes, absolutely, this is not a red state, blue state thing. It is a cross. That's why we describe the organization as cross-partisan, not even bipartisan, because there's those plenty of independents out there, the libertarians or the independent party voters who don't identify with either party. And perhaps principally because they feel that the parties have left them behind, are not responsive enough to the voters.
Now, 19 states have already passed a resolution,
right,
which, and I'm a little unclear on this, whether it is a resolution to ask Congress to have a constitutional convention to put forward a 28th Amendment,
right,
or is it to ask Congress to consider this, or what exactly?
Well,
and that's about half of what is needed. They need 38 states.
Right. They need 38 states. And actually, the Senate and Congress needs to come up with something that then they can send out to
ratified
by right. the states.
Yeah. Well, as I was looking, there are currently two leading 28th Amendment bills that are in Congress. One received about 54 votes in the Senate last Congress and has about 95 co-sponsors in the House. And that's a three-section amendment that said Congress can regulate and set limits on the raising and spending of money by candidates and others to influence elections. They can distinguish between natural persons and corporations or other artificial entities created by law.
Right.
So I assume that would be political action groups from, say, labor unions or,
right.
or the American Rifle Association or anything in between, correct?
Right. And one of the things goes to the heart of my work, because I've been writing about this for about 16 years, and one of the things that I often get pushback when I say, you know, we need to kind of right-size corporate speech rights is that, well, you know, the ACLU or these many political organizations are also corporations, and you can't distinguish between those and for-profit businesses. And I say, well, you know, actually the tax code makes such distinctions. 501c3 is a, you know, an educational with American
I don't think
promise.
You can give money to a political candidate.
Right, right. And a 501c4, which is what our grassroots organization is, does political organizing, and you can't actually deduct that on your taxes. And we make these kinds of distinctions all the time. This is not what we call invidious discrimination. It's not like discriminating against somebody on the basis of race, sexual orientation, gender, the sort of things that go to your humanity. Corporations are tools. They're legal entities that we've set up to help make life better and to help capitalism work. And they work very well in many circumstances. But part of our attitude is that it's gotten out of balance. So,
yeah. The final section of that first bill is nothing in this article shall be construed to grant Congress or the states the power to abridge the freedom of the press.
Right.
Now, that's the whole thing. What the freedom of the press, what does that mean? And what are First Amendment's right in this new post-Citizens United world?
This is one of the really interesting, and this gets us into a little technical questions, right, again, about the First Amendment. But the First Amendment has several clauses. As you may know, the Freedom of Expression Clause, Congress shall make no law abridging, you know, freedom of speech, is one clause. But there's another clause, or the press, and that is actually a separate clause. The Supreme Court's current interpretation of the First Amendment has been to collapse those into each other and to say, well, you know, freedom of press doesn't mean anything other than what freedom of speech means. That has not always been the doctrine, and it violates what we lawyers would call normal conventions of statutory interpretation, which is you don't look at a statute or a law and say the drafters of it just put in something that was redundant and extra. If they wrote something different, it was because they really had something different in mind. So press must be something different than just freedom of speech. And I would like to see us go back to that and go back to the idea that the press has a constitutional duty. And with that duty comes some different kinds of freedom and different kinds of constraints or, you know, freedoms than just you know, the freedom that is extended to every citizen.
And especially now that money is considered speech
right.
under the First Amendment.
Right. Since 1974 in Buckley v. Vallejo, that's been a long, long time. Yeah. And I should point out, you know, we sometimes use language that's a little bit technically sloppy in terms of it's just because it's easier to understand to say overturn Citizens United. But technically, only the Supreme Court can overturn. What we would like to do is to pass an amendment that would render Citizens United a nullity.
A moot
decision, or that to would send a message to the court. We don't agree. We, the people, do not agree with this decision. And I think that's something that's possible. So I really like the language of that particular one, because it does separate all of these not exactly the same issues, the size of money in politics, the status of the press, and the status of corporation. It separates those out nicely.
My guest today is Tamara Piety. She is an advisory council member of American Promise. American Promise launched their Oklahoma State chapter over the weekend to nullify the Citizens United Supreme Court decision through a constitutional amendment. Now, that language is still to be determined. I've mentioned one of them. The other one is a two-section We the People amendment, which basically says first and center that the rights of the Constitution are granted to natural persons only.
Right.
And that would take the whole corporations issue out of this. Is that more expansive?
I think that's a little more expansive than it needs to be. I think the problem is that the First Amendment has to always be interpreted. So there's lots of speech that the First Amendment does not apply to. Contracts, perjury. I mean, there are many contexts where we don't allow you to say whatever you want to. And so you often have to try to interpret what does it mean? What does it apply to? What does it mean in light of what was intended by the framers? And I think the purpose of trying to get for-profit business corporations to not have the same speech rights as individuals is to try to really encourage them to do what Milton Friedman, the godfather of capitalism, suggested was really their main business, which is to do business. And they do that well. That's what they're trained to do. They're not trained to do social policy. And we can't do anything if they make social policy choices that we don't agree with. The average voter has no vote on the ExxonMobil board.
Right.
So, you know, that said, corporations do need to be able to bring lawsuits, and there's probably some things like due process that should still apply to corporations. And this is not a, American Promise is not a anti-corporation as such organization. Rather, we're interested in trying to see, again, this sort of right-sizing in the context of people, with respect to people.
That section one, again, it takes constitutional rights away from corporations and various legal entities.
Right.
And it says that they'll be governed by laws, not by inherent constitutional rights.
Right.
The second part says they shall regulate and limit or prohibit contributions and expenditures, whether it's candidates' own contributions or basically it's talking about a leveling of the playing field in the,
right.
the political contributions. And it says that the spending of money to influence elections to be speech, that basically disallows that.
Right. That's trying to address Buckley v. Vallejo, which is, again, predates Citizens United. Buckley said that money was speech and that you couldn't regulate at least expenditures on political advertising and so forth. I think that's really, really important. That's a really important part. It won't be enough if we just talk about the corporate participation, because we do need to get to the size, just the sheer size of some spending. And the really, I mean, I think many of the folks that are funding elections and but to the tune of millions of dollars are true believers in the things that they're trying to fund. They probably have good motives, but that's not the way a democracy is really supposed to work, I think. So
Where is the state chapter? Are you going to concentrate on the legislature first? Or would you look at, you know, Oklahoma is one of those states where you can, if you get enough signatures, you can put anything on a ballot.
Right.
what's the plan?
Well, right now, we just kicked off. And in fact, our organizer is Liz Horowitz, and I believe you can contact her. And I should have her email in front of me, but I don't. But it may well be that we have a Facebook page. So I think that's going to be developed by people now. So people who came to this meeting and anyone else who's interested in getting involved, they're going to be having sort of conference calls every couple of weeks. And that's one of the things they're going to decide is what's the best strategy. What should we prioritize? Should we try to look at a referendum? Should we look at maybe a local something from the city? I think that's to be determined. I'm sort of more an advisor rather than the main organizer. So,
yeah. Well, so far 19 states have passed it. What is your assessment? Do you think you could get 38 states to consider this? Do you think that Congress might consider this?
Two things. First is we have to remember that the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act, which Citizens United partially overturned, was also known as McCain-Feingold. McCain was a sponsor of this. And I think many, many, many members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are very unhappy at the amount of time they have to spend raising money and believe that there's a problem. So I think there's a receptiveness there. They have to see that the people care about it. They have to see that their own getting returned to office might hinge on whether or not they're pursuing this agenda and whether or not that they're being responsive to voters. And I think if they see motion from, you know, they see momentum, ultimately, this is one of the geniuses and the beauties of this country still is that the people can make stuff happen. I think we, maybe in my lifetime, I'm 58, so I'm on the older side here, but I think maybe in my lifetime, we got a little bit complacent about how much we needed to be involved in politics in order for our government to be responsive to our concerns.
I think there are opportunities where both sides feel the pressure of this money. But right now, I think that the perception, at least looking from outside of the Beltway, is that a party that caters to corporate interests has a vested interest in keeping the system the way it is right now.
Yes and no. I think part of what's happening is that, and I think this is just a dreadful, dreadful aspect of the current moment that we're in, is that some of the folks that are pushing the kind of corporate speech concerns or the funders, the big funders' concerns, feel like they can get the people to like anything that they put in front of them, sometimes by really propagandist techniques that mislabel things or call things. It's really a 1984 kind of world where, you know, we'll call this bill the opposite of what it actually is doing and people won't know any different. And that's why I say I think maybe we got a little complacent and we thought we didn't need to pay attention to what our government was doing. And I think people are paying more attention. And so until corporations can also vote, or unless there's actual hacking of the election machinery, which right now, knock wood, so far, even though there were attempts to break in and hack, it looks like they were unsuccessful, mostly. What was successful was some of the propaganda aspects, and people are paying more attention. They're being a little more skeptical. I think they're looking for.
Well, and you know, in Oklahoma, we have not experienced the level of just sheer political volume that many states, say if you lived in Ohio in
right.
2016 or Florida in 2016,
right.
If you live in Alabama right now in 2018
right.
And you're a Republican voter, you're getting swamped with
right.
material. I mean, it's not one piece a day. It's multiple pieces. It's multiple emails.
Right.
Every website you go to is showered with this.
Right.
And I just wonder if until Oklahomans experience that sort of level of political volume, it will make an impact.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think people care about this issue. Just seeing how motivated some of the folks were who came out for our meeting with very not too much notice about it and spent 4 hours on a Saturday afternoon, that's really quite remarkable that they're willing to give up that much time. And we see this in many other things going on in the community on many different issues, Black Lives Matter, postcard writing campaigns. We see people running for office who hadn't run for office before. And there are many points of commonality in all of this, that is political kind of consciousness and awareness and getting involved. And so I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
I'm modestly hopeful.
Now, as a First Amendment scholar, you know, there's a number of issues about the responsiveness of government. Rendering Citizens United moot is one. Another one is, and this is going to be taken up by the Supreme Court this year, the gerrymandering.
Right.
And when I, you know, I look at the inability of parties to compromise, a lot of it is because they're worried about veering from political orthodoxy.
Right.
And, you know, it's because they're all from gerrymandered districts.
Right.
I'm wondering if that is a first step, or why do you think Citizens United is the first step? I guess that's
Well, I think we get into gerrymandering, and now we're really outside of my area of expertise. I don't know anything about it, although I think, you know, I'm sort of like probably a lot of citizens who kind of have this very simple gerrymandering bad, you know, idea. Uh-huh. I think I'm cautiously, maybe in some circumstances, there were some defensible reasons for trying to draw districts to increase minority participation, particularly where you had didn't have enough minority participation in government. But it's gotten out of hand again. So it's like sort of maybe right-sizing it or returning that to some sort of sanity. But this is easier to understand than gerrymandering, I think.
Uh-huh.
And it is more fundamental, I think more basic. Whether or not we can get it done remains to be seen. But I will say that on the website, I think you can find a video about how many amendments were passed in the 20th century. I bet most people don't know that there were 12 in just the 20th century alone. And probably people know about prohibition and then the repeal of prohibition, but also which shows that we can fix our mistakes if we make a mistake. But and the vote for women, the 19th Amendment, but also things that are more seem like a little more prosaic, but arose out of like the Vietnam conflict. Get the right to vote being 18. People were outraged that you could be drafted and sent to die for a war that these kids were not able to vote for their elected officials in. And so that was an amendment to the Constitution in the 20th century. And it always seems like a big hill to climb, but you got to start someplace. So,
all right. Well, it's at AmericanPromise.net. So people can learn more that way, and they can also figure out a way to get in touch with local officials in Oklahoma.
Right. And they can look on Facebook for the Facebook page for the Oklahoma
chapter. All right. Well, Tamara, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Tamara Piety is an American Promise Advisory Council member, a First Amendment law specialist, and a University of Tulsa law professor. American Promise launched their Oklahoma State chapter over the weekend to counteract the Citizens United Supreme Court decision through a proposed 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If you'd like to learn more about American Promise, visit their website at AmericanPromise.net. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.